You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, mystery writer Agatha Christie had more than a few secrets of her own. And tonight at 6 on 1A+, a revealing look at the woman behind the pages of some of our most beloved crime novels. But now, former President Ronald Reagan, often cited as having transformed the Republican Party. As we look back at the 1990s following his presidency, we do begin to see a switch in conservative politics and ideologies, often toward a far more far-right approach. One historian joins us now to talk about how Reagan, among other politicians, reshaped politics as we know them today. And, of course, we'd invite you to join our conversation at any point. Call us 1-800-642-1234. Did you vote for Reagan in the 90s? Do you still vote Republican? And did Reagan change your political affiliation? You think there's too big of a divide in politics today? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Nicole Hemmer, an associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University who specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right. Her most recent book is Partisans, the conservative revolutionaries who remade American politics in the 1990s. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Lee.
Yeah, let's start with Ronald Reagan. And as you retell the history of the Republican Party through the 1990s, where do we start? Does it start with Ronald Reagan, or is Ronald Reagan a bookend of a previous chapter? How does he fit in your history?
So in many ways, people understand Reagan as the start of something new. He was the first popular landslide-winning conservative president to win in the second half of the 20th century. But what I talk about in the book is the way that Reagan was fundamentally a Cold War president. He was somebody for whom the logic of the Cold War really shaped his politics, his rhetoric, his policies. And when the Cold War came to an end in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, it created this space for a new more pessimistic, less popular, more antagonistic conservatism to emerge. And that's what we see happen is the rise of this sort of old new right that has its roots in the 1930s and 40s, but is very modern in terms of things like its use of media.
Well, and the term that comes back from the 30s and 40s that we heard in the elections in the last few years would be America First.
That's right. That's something that Pat Buchanan, who was a Republican presidential candidate in 1992 and 96, and then runs on the reform ticket in 2000, he brings that idea of America First back in his 1992 campaign. He actually writes members of the old American First Committee, this group that opposed U.S. intervention in World War II, and says, hey, I want to bring back this foreign policy that says the U.S. should not get involved in foreign entanglements, that we should be focused more on home. So it's a much more nationalistic kind of fortress America view of what the nation should be.
And Nicole, as you write in your new book, Partisans, that this America First is not anything new, but at the same time, there is the running theme of Pat Buchanan through the history of the Republican Party before the 1990s, going back to the Nixon administration, and using these phrases that would be co-opted by Donald Trump as he ran for president.
That's right. Pat Buchanan is such a fascinating figure. As you mentioned, he comes up through the Nixon administration when he was still in his 20s. He joins Richard Nixon. And at the time, he is a representative of the conservative movement in an administration that was like interested in the conservative movement, but not necessarily as far to the right as conservatives would have preferred. And so as Republican presidents get increasingly conservative, Pat Buchanan actually gets increasingly conservative as well. And he emerges in 1992 to fill what he called the political vacuum in American politics, which he saw as the space to the right of Ronald Reagan.
And Nicole Hemmer, our guest, and join us at any point, 800-642-1234. But as you write in Partisans, that Reagan Republicanism was largely a response to the Cold War and a reaction to communism and a stand against the former Soviet Union. But after the end of the Cold War, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, there was a question about what this sort of what the Republican Party would stand for and what it would be about. As we get to the 2000s, past the 1990s, how do you see the Republican Party's platform playing out after the Cold War?
So after the Cold War, particularly in the 2000s, you kind of have a Reaganism revival. People often forget this, but when George W. Bush won the election in 2000 when he becomes president, he's seen as the heir not of George H.W. Bush, but of Ronald Reagan, his compassionate conservatism, as he liked to call it, his approach to immigration reform after the 9/11 attacks, his use of democracy as the language that was shaping his foreign policy rhetoric. All of these things reminded people of Ronald Reagan. But over the course of his presidency, you know, the democracy promotion abroad leads to the debacles in Iraq and Afghanistan. The tax cuts and deregulation help contribute to the global financial collapse. The idea that government doesn't have a role to play is really brought into question after Hurricane Katrina. And so because of the failures of the second Bush administration, you see an even bigger space for this new post-Cold War right to emerge. And that's what you see in the 20-teens with the Tea Party first and then with the rise of Donald Trump.
I have to ask, Nicole Hemmer, what role did the Democratic Party play in all this during the 1990s as you had triangulation from President Clinton, who was to some degree co-opting some conservative priorities in order to get something done during his administration? What did this do to the GOP?
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating because you're exactly right. In the 1990s, the Democratic Party really does move to the right. You see this on things like immigration. You have harsher immigration restrictions under Bill Clinton. You have people like Dianne Feinstein in California pushing for more immigration restriction. And instead of creating a kind of middle ground where Republicans and Democrats meet and come up with bipartisan legislation, what you tend to see more often is the Republican Party moving even further to the right in order to make sure that the distinctions between Democrats and Republicans remain stark. And so it has this, I think, unexpected effect of helping to push the Republican Party even further to the right in the 1990s.
1-800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guest, Nicole Hemmer, Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book, Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. And your previous book, if I'm not mistaken, Nicole, was about the conservative media, Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. When does Rush Limbaugh show up on the scene? Because For some, it would seem like he'd always been there, but he was part of the 1990 conservative movement as well, wasn't he?
He was. So that first book that I wrote, Messengers of the Right, really looked at the role that conservative media activists played during the Cold War era. Mm. And in Partisans, I look at this second generation of conservative media activists. And of course, one of those, as you mentioned, is Rush Limbaugh. His radio show goes national in 1988. And he really does fill what conservatives see as a vacuum in the wake of the Reagan administration. In fact, in 1992, after George H.W. Bush loses his reelection, Ronald Reagan writes a letter to Rush Limbaugh that says, "You are now the number one voice of conservatism in the United States." And that's the way that Limbaugh is treated, as a kind of avatar for the conservative base during the 92 election when Bush is not doing great in the polls. He actually invites Rush Limbaugh to the White House in order to win him over so that Rush Limbaugh will say nice things about him and hopefully bring conservatives along and make them more excited. So what you see first in Limbaugh and then in other pundits and eventually the rise of Fox News is a conservative media apparatus that is growing more and more powerful and that politicians feel they have to win over in order to win elections. That's something that's very new in the 1990s.
And as you detail in Partisans, it's Roger Ailes, late Roger Ailes, formerly of Fox News, who is cutting his teeth on TV, conservative TV media, with Rush Limbaugh as he briefly had a TV show there. I think, was that the early 90s?
That was the early 90s as well. So in 1992, when Rush Limbaugh really is at the height of his new influence, he has just written two best-selling books, and Ailes decides to pick him up for a syndicated evening television show. And it does fairly well. It plays across the country for about 4 years. And Ailes will leave that project in 1996 to go and to start Fox News. But he was absolutely instrumental in arranging things like that visit to the Bush White House, because of course, Ailes had been a Republican consultant from the Nixon era on through George H.W. Bush.
Nicole Hemmer, our guest, associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University, also a political historian who specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right. Nicole has written the books Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics, and most recently, Partisans, the conservative revolutionaries who remade American politics in the 1990s. Want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. With the outsized role of Pat Buchanan or the lasting legacy of Ronald Reagan, how do you see where the GOP stands today, and can you draw a line back through history to help explain where we are today, as opposed to some who would say that that Donald Trump was an anomaly or an outsider or an outlier? There's an argument to be made. It's part of the same language that at least Pat Buchanan used back when he was running for president in the early 90s on the Republican ticket. Tell us what you think, 1-800-642-1234, or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation with Nicole Hemmer next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we continue our talk with Nicole Hemmer, associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University, talking with us about her new book, Partisans, in which we're diving into how conservative politics in the 90s reshaped the Republican Party that we know today. And you can join us at any point, 1-800-642-1234. Did Republican tactics or strategy from the 1990s convince you to vote Republican or Democrat? Do you think the conservative party is too far right from what it used to be or should be? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's turn now to Jeff in Superior, who joins us. Jeff, you're on the air with Nicole Hemmer.
Good afternoon. Before Reagan was elected president, he lived through an era where you had Robert Byrd, who was a conservative Democrat, and Barry Goldwater, who was a conservative Republican. And Ronald Reagan was a Democrat who became a Republican because he had a desire to put America on a kind of a mainstream course between those two extremes. Robert Byrd was a racist. Blair Goldwater was, you know, a little loose with the military. And I think Ronald Reagan really set the pace. And that's why he won with such a landslide, was that he believed that government was there to protect us from each other. I heard him actually say that at a speech. And he believed that America was going to survive the extremes.
Jeff, I appreciate that. And Nicole Hemmer, you certainly write about this in your new book, Partisans.
That's right. Yes. One of the things that made Reagan in many ways singular in the 1980s, you know, you mentioned Barry Goldwater, and Barry Goldwater was somebody who had the same set of conservative ideas, but he couldn't make them popular. In 1964, when he ran for president, he lost in one of the biggest landslides in American history. And so what was so important about Reagan was he kind of cracked the code for how to sell conservatism to voters in a way that made it popular and actually expanded the voting base of the Republican Party. This is the era in which you hear about the Reagan Democrat. And that really does hold throughout the 1980s. And it comes apart pretty quickly by the time that you get to the 1990s. You find Republicans and conservatives holding on to a smaller and smaller share of the electorate. And so that's part of what I talk about in Partisans, how they lose their grip on that very popular conservatism of Ronald Reagan.
1-800-642-1234 to join the conversation with Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University, Nicole Hemmer, whose new book is Partisans. Let's turn now to Steve in Sun Prairie. Steve, you're on Central Time. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm 50 years old, and in my lifetime, what I've seen is the media continue to move further and further, further to the left. So when you talk about activists, you know, media, you can put NPR as an activist media. And so what these other people found, the Rush Limbaughs, the Mark Bellings of the world, Fox News, there was a place where conservatives' voice could be heard and not be judged. And I wanted to know what the guest's thoughts are on it. It's not so much these people are an issue. It's the fact that the media, such as NPR, have become activists. And so they created an opening for other players.
Steve, thank you. And as you mentioned this, I'm thinking about our conversation, Nicole, of the Democratic Party and Republican Party both moving towards the right in the 90s. So if everything else stayed in the middle, it could feel like it was moving to the left. As you look at it, the media landscape had a void that certainly was filled by Fox News and Rush Limbaugh. But has the media become more liberal?
Well, so it's really interesting to look at non-conservative media in the 1990s, because we think about Limbaugh, we think about Fox News as kind of the breeding grounds for conservative media. But actually, somebody like Pat Buchanan came up through PBS's The McLaughlin Group and CNN's Crossfire. People like Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter got their start on MSNBC. And what you had in the 1990s, as you started to get cable news and a broader range of options as more and more Americans got cable and then the internet, is that a lot of non-conservative outlets were actually the places where conservative punditry was being born. But as you go forward into the 2000s, into the 20-teens, that begins to separate out more. That eventually you see these conservative pundits on CNN and MSNBC ultimately are going to find a home on Fox News, and what's left behind are people who aren't conservative. And so you do get something shaking out there when it comes to the different cable news outlets and different radio outlets. There is something that conservatives were responding to in the media landscape, but they had been responding to it not since the early 1990s, but since like the early 1950s, when National Review began as a conservative magazine in 1955, it was making the exact same case that the media are too liberal and that there need to be a space for conservative voices. And so this is part of what is now, you know, a 70-year project to create this conservative media infrastructure.
Interesting, Nicole, that we're talking about the history of the Republican Party, your book Partisans, and the Republicans who remade American politics in the 1990s. And our callers are talking about the media this afternoon. Let's turn now to Steve and Stevens Point, who joins us along with our guest, Nicole Hemmer. Steve, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was just wondering what your guest thought was the influence of political satirists like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Bill Maher, and what the reaction of the Republican Party was to that political satire.
Steve, thank you. And you talk about Bill Maher and Politically Incorrect in your book Partisans.
This is such a great question. Yes, I talk about Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect because it was emblematic of a change that was happening in political media. And that is, the walls between news and entertainment were thinning so much that, you know, by the end of the 1990s into the 2000s, they were mostly non-existent. And Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect is so interesting because it would eventually end up on ABC because it was so popular, but it started off on Comedy Central. And it was the place where, in particular, conservatives hung out with actors and comedians and learned to be outrageous and funny in that setting on Bill Maher's show. Now, Bill Maher, as I mentioned, he moves to ABC in 1997. Comedy Central had really found a niche with Bill Maher, and they wanted more programming that blended politics and comedy. And that's where you get The Daily Show. That's where you get eventually the Colbert Report. And so in many ways, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are the heirs of this change that was happening in the 1990s. And Bill Maher really was the leader of a lot of that change.
Nicole Hemmer, Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and author of the new book Partisans, our guest. Let's go to Ben in Milwaukee now. Ben, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Another caller brought up Reagan and the different politics going on back then. And it made me think of something in my question to Mrs. Hemmers. If you think that losing the fairness doctrine gave, you know, let the guardrails down and gave rise to a more partisan landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. The fairness doctrine made sure that there was a balance and equity in reporting both sides. But as that went away, was that the vacuum that allowed conservative media to grow?
So it was part of the vacuum that allowed conservative media to grow. That regulatory change happens in 1987, where under the Reagan administration, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, gets rid of the fairness doctrine. And at the time, you actually have people like Newt Gingrich and Trent Lott and Phyllis Schlafly, these conservative activists and office holders, who are like, actually, we want the fairness doctrine to be put back in place. Because by that point, there were a lot of conservatives who saw the fairness doctrine, to the point of an earlier caller, as a way of balancing out liberal media bias. right? That you could use the fairness doctrine to say that conservatives deserved more of a say on air. It's really not until the rise of Rush Limbaugh, until he becomes this powerful figure, that conservatives are like, actually, you know what? You don't need the fairness doctrine. But I say only partially because you also needed a number of technological changes to happen to allow conservative media to flourish in the ways that it did. And I think it's the combination of the changes in regulation and technology that make it possible for conservative media to flourish in the 1990s and beyond.
Well, was it the Clinton signing of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that led to Rush Limbaugh being on over 400 stations nationwide and found just about anywhere?
So that deregulation makes a huge difference, as does, of course, technologically, the rise of the internet. So there's so much stuff that's happening on both the regulatory and technology front in this period.
We are woefully short of time, Nicole Hammer, but you end your book talking about pitchfork politics, and pitchforks and torches have made, at least verbally, an entrance into the Senate race here in Wisconsin. Can you explain what this is for us?
Sure. So pitchfork politics are this idea of, in many ways, like the people revolting. That was the image that Pat Buchanan tapped into in his 92 and his 96 campaign, that it was time to overthrow the establishment. And it's that same kind of anti-establishment politics that you're seeing there in Wisconsin, but that we're seeing across the United States as well.
Nicole Hammer, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole's an associate professor of history at Vanderbilt University, and she specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right, joining us to talk about her most recent book, Partisans, the Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it is Food Friday, so get ready. James Shen from Taste of Home magazine is bringing a list of copycat recipes from some of your favorite restaurants that will have you cooking up some meals and desserts that, you know, you wouldn't think you'd be able to do on your own. I'm trying some of my own tonight. We'll report back tomorrow. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, where have all the workers gone? Our workforce has returned to pre-pandemic levels, but there are still millions on the sidelines, and we're going to find out why. First, the notion that parents are done parenting when their kids turn 18 is outdated, to say the least, something every parent knows or is about to learn. The relationship persists, of course. And when you think about it, parents' relationship with their children after they turn 18, well, that's the longest phase of parenthood there is. And while advice books and other resources abound for helping parents navigate things like sleeping, bathroom training, developing emotional intelligence, there's a real lack of help available for parents in this longest phase of parenthood with their young adult kids. So we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. If you're the parent of a young adult child, or if you're a young adult child yourself, how's your relationship? If you don't mind sharing a little bit on the air, we'd love to hear. What challenges have you faced? And have you been able to resolve some of those challenges? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Julie Halpert, journalist who covers a wide variety of topics, including parenting, mental health, and the environment. Her work has appeared in numerous large media outlets, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Atlantic. And she recently wrote about this topic for the Atlantic. Her piece is called There Is No Roadmap for the Longest Phase of Parenthood. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And let's begin with this notion that somehow parenting is done when a kid turns 18. Where did this antiquated idea come from?
It came from the way life was many years ago, like in the 50s and the 60s. People tended to get married young, start their lives at a younger age with a partner, move out of the house at that time. And it was just a very different world then. And now, obviously, things are very different. And that is no longer the case. There isn't this sense that once you're 18, you leave home and start your own life in quite the same way as you saw maybe in the 50s or 60s or years before that.
So emerging adulthood then, and the relationship these emerging adults have to their parents. When you turn 18, from 18 to 20-something year olds all the way to perhaps 30, an overlooked developmental phase, as you mentioned in your article in The Atlantic. But why do we overlook it, Julie?
I think it's just honestly because it's so new. It's really a trend that we've seen over the past several years. There are a lot of factors that make being a young adult really hard. You know, it's many young adults have an incredible amount of student loan debt from college. The economy is uncertain. For getting that first job, it can be very difficult. A lot of young adults are facing a lot of emotional struggles. And then you layer on COVID, which has occurred over the past couple of years. It's a very challenging time for young adults now in the way it never used to be.
But what about the parents that say once the kid turns 18, they're out my door? They're everybody else's responsibility. That's what college is for, or the military, or marriage for that matter.
Well, marriage, it's interesting. I had mentioned this in my piece that because people tend to get married later, having that partner as your main source of emotional support, it's not happening as early as it once did. So they're often maintaining that kind of support they have with their parents. I suppose there are some parents who feel that way, but I think what's really unique about this generation in a good way is that their parents are very close to their children. There used to be more of a hierarchy where parents sort of dictated what should happen and the kids obeyed. And it was less of a peer relationship. I think these days you're seeing much more of a peer relationship between children and their parents. There's a closeness that they have, and they don't just want to throw them out the door if they're struggling.
Yeah. Julie Halpert, our guest, taking a look at what's available for parents of emerging adults, those who are 18 to 20-somethings in the developmental phase, the longest stage of parenthood, as our guest Julie Halpert writes. And Julie, you draw a line then, connecting this phase being overlooked and there being an absolute dearth of resources for helping parents with it, at least compared with the Dr. Spocks of the world and the abundance of resources for parents with younger children. Is there, you see the connection there. What have you found in investigating it?
Well, I found that there's not much. I spoke with Jeffrey Arnett, who wrote an incredible book that is really a guide for parents and parenting kids in their 20s. There isn't much out there. And I think it's, again, this is really new terrain that we're navigating. I also think there is no sort of one size fits all approach. I mean, if you've got a young a toddler who, you know, needs help getting toilet trained or won't sleep through the night, or, you know, those are situations where there are very concrete solutions that tend to work in the same way for all people. But young adults are very different, and they're not a monolith. And it's hard to know exactly how to solve some of the problems that they're facing. It's extremely challenging, but there is definitely not that much guidance out there on this topic. And I think it's definitely needed. I've heard from lots of parents who would be eager for that kind of guidance.
Yeah, well, it's, for example, what about when millennials move back home to save some money? What's the relationship then after a child leaves the home but then returns to it? Something I myself have done.
Yeah, well, honestly, I think it depends on the parent and the child. And I've written about this actually. I did a piece for the New York Times a while ago about even what it's like when your child comes home for the summer and they feel like they're an independent adult, but they're still acting like a child. There are all kinds of, I actually provided some advice from experts on that about how do you set rules and establish boundaries and expectations so that you can have a harmonious relationship. It can be very complicated. You know, I've spoken with parents who are loved having their adult children home with them during COVID actually. And then others who felt like, It was hard. So it honestly, it just really depends.
Yeah, Julie, I read that piece from the New York Times last year about how the pandemic caused a lot of college students to return home and take classes virtually and how that impacted the relationships with their parents. What else did you learn there about, again, emerging adulthood and these relationships?
Do you mean in the Atlantic piece or do you mean generally?
Generally.
You know, I think that what I learned was that it's a really trying time for these young adults, and parents who had more of a straight roadmap when they were growing up sometimes have a hard time relating to their struggles of their children. Things were very direct. You know, you went to college, you came out, you got a very steady job, you were able to buy a house. Houses, by the way, are very expensive now. It's not so easy to do that. And things just, you know, seem very prescribed. I think this younger generation, they have, there's a lot of uncertainty. They don't know, you know, when they're going to really earn a stable income. They don't know when they'll be able to afford a house. They don't know when they're going to be able to find a romantic partner, someone to spend the rest of their life with. And there's a lot of uncertainty. And they often turn to their parents along the way. And I would say, though, if there's one thing positive that's come out of this, and also that I learned when I was working on the New York Times piece, is that young adults and their parents have a very wonderful and close relationship, and this has brought them closer. And I did mention this in the Atlantic piece too, that as the young adult becomes an older adult, it makes it more likely that they're willing to care for their parents as they age and as they need care. Their young adult, you know, so it becomes more reciprocal. And there's a lovely close bonding. A lot of these parents I talked to said that they would never have turned to their parents with problems in the way that their children turn to them. And they're grateful for that. So I think that while it can be challenging, overall, there's a real closeness between this generation of parents and their adult children that is actually quite refreshing. And hopefully in the end, we'll make it all worthwhile.
And let me invite parents and adult children to join the conversation with their experiences and questions about seeking out advice for this longest stage of adulthood, as our guest Julie Halpert writes in The Atlantic this month. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@wpr.org. And one of the aspects that that you mentioned in the New York Times piece from last year about the pandemic and how that's changed the relationship with parents and emerging adults, children, is the idea that what we're looking at now here is the empty nest, but the empty nest again, that parents or children are coming back to the home and then leaving again, and you have this second empty nest experience from the parents. How do they deal with that loss?
You know, shockingly, they were very, very, very sad about that. So that was interesting, because I think parents felt like they had some bonus time with their adult children. And sometimes it wasn't just their children. It was their children and their spouses and their grandchildren. this was time that they felt like, you know, once your kid leaves and moves out of the nest, that your family starts to move on, and it's just you and your spouse or partner, or maybe you by yourself. These families sort of had an extra time with their nuclear family. And they often really enjoyed it. I mean, of course, there were, you know, the issues with housework and people not cleaning up after themselves and that sort of thing. But I think they got to be really close. I mean, I experienced this firsthand. My daughter moved back with us for the year. And while she was very eager to leave, we really were grateful for the time with her. We really never expected to be living under our roof. And I don't expect she will again. But I think when the kids left a second time, you know, just as you adjust to your child leaving for college, that was an adjustment they had to make again that they didn't anticipate. And it was really hard for some of these parents. Not to say, I'm sure if you check back with them a few months later, they're just doing fine.
Right.
But initially it was challenging.
But they feel a loss. There's a real loss there. And it's something to think about. Julie Halpert is a journalist who covers a wide variety of topics, including parenting, mental health, and the environment. You'll find her byline in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the article we're talking about today in The Atlantic. And if you have questions or if you have shared experiences that may help us understand better this relationship of emerging adulthood children and their parents and the lack of advice you'll find, join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email us ideas@wpr.org, and we'll continue our conversation with Julie Halpert coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up the conversation about navigating the challenges of being the parent of a young adult, maybe even a middle-aged adult, or maybe one approaching 50, with our journalist Julie Halpert as our guest. And you along for the ride. I want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us ideas@wpr.org and tell us your shared experience and what you've ask your questions for our guest, Julie Halpert. Let's go to Colette in Eagle River right now. Colette, good afternoon. You're on Central Time with Julie Halpert.
Oh, thank you, Julie. I have something that has I'm now an older adult, as my children are hitting, well, one is 34, one is 32, but I think it's going to be a really intense experience until I die. My oldest son has high-functioning autism. He's independent of sorts, but he's still disabled and on Social Security. Mm-hmm. And my other son, who's now 32, and probably finally independent, I thought I was going to have to take care of him for the rest of my life, too. I had severe ADHD and dyslexia. And I will still, this morning, I'm still writing letters for him and fixing up his resume and at 32. And I don't know because he's so dyslexic and he's so ADHD. He's able to finally hold a steady job, but it's been tough.
Colette, I can't thank you enough for calling in and joining us this afternoon. And Julie, I hear you there nodding along in agreement. And something we never get advice on is, what if your adult child has special needs? And where can you go? Where can you turn? And what can you do?
Well, I'm not an expert on, and by the way, I'm so sorry. I can't even imagine how challenging that must be. I would hope that there are support groups and places you can go. As a parent of an autistic child, I have a friend who actually has two children who are autistic, and I know has similar struggles. And I'm sure it's daunting. Honestly, I've really been wanting to write a piece about people like you who are parents of autistic children and are planning for your future and how they're going to be cared for in the future. And I unfortunately have no answers. I would hope that there are, you know, like support groups out there and places that can give you advice on where to turn, because I'm sure it's extraordinarily hard.
And Julie, when you publish the story, we'll have to talk about it here on Central Time.
Yeah, that's on my list of stories I really want to do. So, yeah.
Outstanding. And thank you again, Colette, for calling. Let's go now to Mary, who's in Vilas County. Mary, good afternoon. You're on Central Time with Julie Halpert.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So first of all, I'm a retired academic advisor from an higher ed institution, and I spent a lot of years working with this age group, and I feel like so far in the show, there's a lot of happy talk about when young people come home, how much some families enjoy that during the pandemic, and how difficult it can be for parents to go through that second empty nest. People move back home. It is for very serious and very difficult issues for parents to deal with, like addiction or mental health issues. And I guess I'd like to talk with you a little, or have you talk a little bit about navigating that for parents, because once somebody is 18 years old, you can't make medical appointments for them anymore. You can't make them do anything. And like how parents set limits, what they can do. You don't want to put your child on the street, but, you know, when you set limits in your home and then they're not meeting them, I mean, this is really difficult. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing. Yes, Julie, when you're dealing with some of the difficult issues of addiction and mental health issues, and there's concern about turning your kid out or turning him into law enforcement, where do you turn?
Yeah, I certainly didn't mean to sugarcoat how complex this can be and how there are many situations where young adults are moving back home. Also, for financial reasons, it can be also very stressful. I actually did write a piece for the New York Times about how to, with some resources, if you feel like your young adult is struggling with their mental health issues. Unfortunately, it did not get into, you know, what happens if your child has a severe addiction issue and you're faced with having to put them on the street. You know, there are experts on that are better informed than I to, I wouldn't want to speak about that because I feel like I'm not well-versed in that. And again, I would hope that there are support groups and places you can find that deal with addiction issues that can give you some insights on how to handle that very, very complicated and I'm sure emotionally trying situation.
Yeah, Mary, thank you again. And we're going to put up a link that the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin has for community resources for families and children. And you'll find that at WPR.org/Central Time, along with today's interview. So there will be resources up there for you. And you mentioned Jeffrey Arnett's book before, Julie Halpert. And I want to make sure we mention that again, because it was one of the resources that you found in looking for good advice for parents of emerging adults. Emerging Adulthood? Is that the name of the book?
It's getting to, I wish I had it in front of me. I don't have it in front of me. Getting to 20 or I'm sure that I can, we can look it up and add it to the list of resources that you provide.
We will do just that. Let's go now to Deb in Wausau. Deb, you're on Central Time with Julie Halpert.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you have?
Well, I am. I've recently have sent an 18-year-old granddaughter off to college. She didn't live with me, but she's lived with her mother, and this has been a very trying time for both of them. She's playing the "I'm 18" card, and and for every reason but to be helpful around the house and be respectful.
Well, I have played that card myself. What's the relationship like right now?
Well, she went to college with her stepmother and not with her mom, and her mom's heart's broken because there's really been no communication since she left 3 weeks ago.
Julie.
It's horrible.
And Deb, thank you for sharing that story. And yes, when there is a fractured relationship like that, and it's not totally uncommon when you're in those late teens, but there's also opportunity ahead because, as you mentioned in your article in The Atlantic, Julie, this is the longest period of parenthood.
Right. And that's another reason why it would be great if there was some more guidance, because, you know, this starts when you're young, but from 18 to, you know, however long your parents live, that's a really long period of time. So, and it's a time when everybody's changing and growing and the relationship changes and evolves. So there's a lot that's occurring that parents and their adult children could use help with.
I'm 18. I've turned my back on you, but you still love me. What is a parent to do?
Yeah, sometimes it's just a matter of waiting it out and hoping they come back to you, and always reinforcing that you will be there to love and support them. And that support, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean financial support. That's a whole other complicated issue.
Thank you. Jeffrey Arnett's book, by the way, Getting to 30, A Parent's Guide to the 20-something Years. And again, we'll put that all up at WPR.org/Central Time. The book, Getting to 30, A Parent's Guide to the 20-something Years.
Thank you for mentioning that. Sorry.
No, absolutely. I'm glad we got that on the air. Laura now in Black River Falls. Laura, you're on the air with Julie Halpert. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks so much. I am the mother of a 23-year-old daughter and 18-year-old son who just went off to college. And my older daughter, during her later high school years, was definitely more independent. She was all over the place. We definitely had more arguments. And I know to some extent they're just different children and different human beings. But I know that time at the end of high school with her being able to go out with her friends and sort of, you know, test some boundaries and have more independence was really important for her. And we're quite close now. Whereas her younger brother, and she, by the time COVID hit, she was in college in an apartment with her friends, whereas her younger brother had to spend part of his sophomore and all of his junior year at home. And he and I really, during this stage of his life, have not had anywhere near as many conflicts as his sister and I did at that age. But he also it almost feels like there's more than 5 years between them. And I feel like to some extent that I've been thinking a lot about the way in which the pandemic seems to have taken from him this opportunity to be more independent and to, you know, be with his friends and have more of that social development. So it's just been an interesting sort of, feel like I'm handholding him a little bit more as he goes into college than I had to with his sister. And so anyway, just been on my mind. Thanks so much for this show.
Yeah, and you, at the same time, you feel the relationship between your daughter and your son, you see differently?
Between me and my daughter?
Yeah,
and me and my son? I think I would say my daughter and I are now closer now, but she was definitely, that was a really big period of major independence and testing and going off on our own. We barely ever saw her, whereas my son was home all the time. He had to be. So,
right.
I think we've yet to see the impacts of COVID on these young adults, and I think they're going to be significant. I also teach a journalism class at the University of Michigan, so I see the way they are in the world and how hard it has been for them, even if they're not at home, sometimes just to be by themselves in an apartment. There's all kinds of isolation and loneliness. There's all kinds of ways this has really stunted their emotional development. I mean, in time, hopefully they'll be resilient and heal, but I don't think we can overstate the impact of a real disruption in their lives that was really lasted over 2 years. So I can see, you know, your concern, and I'm sure it's hard on these young people, for sure.
Julie Halpert, you have struck a nerve, but we are out of time for today. We will talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Julie Halpert's a journalist, and we talked to her about the latest piece in The Atlantic called There's No Roadmap for the Longest Phase of Parenthood, and you can follow her work at juliehalpert.com. Coming up after the news, we turn to the business desk of the New York Times for answers to the question, where did all the workers go? I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.